Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
In some of my songs, I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's December 6, 2011. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43, joined tonight by my co-host Jen Swertman from The Blind
Tiger.
Hi,
Jimmy.
How are you, Jen?
Doing really well. I've had a really fun beer week.
Anything in particular you'd like to tell us?
Oh, it was a revolving door of fun beer friends. Due to CL's event, was fantastic. Those guys came down from Montreal. And then we had a really wonderful benefit event for a friend of, you know, a beer friend from the city. And Tom Baker and Peggy Baker came up from Earth Bread and Brewing, which is in the Pennsylvania area, and brought beer that we would not get in New York otherwise. So that was really fun.
Well, you guys always do such cool things at Blind Tiger. I'm really happy to introduce our show tonight. We're sponsored by GreatBrewers.com. Learn more about beer, try the beer cloud, take the great beer test, go to greatbrewers.com. It brings the American beer community together, and we're supported by the people at the Good Beer Seal, an association of 34 New York City beer bars. Check it out at goodbeerseal.com. We've got some special guests today. Our theme is Japanese beer and sake show today. A couple people that have been on the show before. We've got John Lundbaum from B United Imports.
Hey, Jimmy. Hey, Jen. How you doing?
So, John, you guys have a wide-ranging portfolio of beers from around the world, but you also have a little piece of Japan in your portfolio, don't you?
Yeah, we do beer and other beverages from 12 or 13 different countries. You know, probably 85 to 90% of it is beer, but we also do sake. And from Japan, we do the Hitachino Brewery and their sake brand, Kikusakari.
So right now we're drinking one of the Hitachino beers. What is it?
It's the Hitachino Red Rice Ale. It's a really remarkable, very unusual beer made with both malted barley as well as red rice and fermented with a beer yeast and a sake yeast.
Well, Hitachino beer, it's really dear to us at Beer Sessions Radio. Last year when there was the earthquake and tsunami in Japan, we got together and organized a fundraiser called Brewers for Brewers at Brooklyn Brewery, and we gave the money, $12,000 we gave to Mr. Koichi of Hitachino.
I believe it was the largest single donation to the fund that we set up with the Koichi Brewery in Japan. Obviously, I was there. It was a spectacular event. They really, really appreciated everyone's support.
Yeah, I mean, brewers from the whole region, you know, from Victory Brewing, Heartland Brewery, Kelso, Six Point, and others came. Home brewers came out. And one of the reasons that happened is our special friend, Corey Etta, who I know as a customer from Jimmy's Number 43. She's a friend of Mr. Koichi from Hitachino. And at the time of the disaster, she asked me if we could organize some kind of event. And she put me in touch with Mr. Koichi, I've met him before. He had been to Jimmy's Number 43.
Absolutely.
And he's a great guy. But Corey, how are you?
Hi, Jimmy.
It's the first time on the show, right?
I know, I'm a little nervous.
Well, tell us a little bit about what happened last year. It was a tragedy for Japan.
Yeah, I mean, it's this year, it was March. It was such a, you know, shock to us. And I was thinking about actually, you know, Mr. Koichi and Hitachino Nest Beer that I love and I adore, because they are in Ibaraki, one of the areas that were not really hit as hard as maybe Miyagi and Fukushima and, you know, other areas. Yet, I heard some disasters and news on it. Then I got newsletter from Hitachino Nest Beer. Being their fan, I get, you know, newsletters from them, and they were saying, you know, our customers, don't worry, we are okay, but the waters that we, you know, the water supply that we kept for our production, we're distributing it to, you know, people who were hit hard in our, you know, area. So I said, oh my God. And I, you know, because I knew, I mean, actually, I am so happy that I have this amazing red ale beer tonight because this was the beer that made me fall in love with Hitachi No-Ness beer, and this was really opportunity for me to meet with Jimmy. So I was thinking about Jimmy, and I sent him an email and saying, hey, Jimmy, can't we do something? Maybe we can do something to help them. And, you know, the rest is the story. I was very touched that all the, you know, beer guys in this country came together to help this disaster in Japan.
That's great. Well, John, we know that at the time Hitachi No-Ness had stopped producing beer. Are they making beer again now?
Oh, absolutely. They're back at full capacity. Hitachi No-Ness, forgive me, I forget the exact number. I think they're somewhere like 12 to 15 miles away from the coast. Their brewery had very, very little damage. I mean, it's practically nothing. The other brewery in their region, however, was completely destroyed, just leveled. And there was a lot of really catastrophic damage. And obviously 12 miles from the coast in their region, there was a lot of really, really horrible damage. So at the time of the disaster, Hitachi No-Ness or the Kyuchi Brewery stopped producing beer, stopped producing sake, stopped producing their shochu, and put all of their efforts towards just distilling water so that or distilling, purifying water so that they could just get pure water to sort of help in the relief effort. And eventually they did start brewing again. Getting the beer to the States at that point was compounded by the fact, or sorry, the difficulty was compounded by the fact that the, you know, sort of existing trade imbalance between the United States and Japan was made that much worse by the disaster. There were no shipping containers going into Japan. Those that did go in were prioritized by those that had relief supplies. And if you don't have a lot of shipping containers going in, you don't have a lot of shipping containers coming out. So that was difficult for a while. Now the supply of Hitachi No-Ness beer is, you know, pretty stable and pretty back where it was. We're going to have another bulk container up and running in the next month or so, and that's going to be exclusively for bringing Hitachi No-Ness beer to the U.S. for kegging. So at that point, hopefully we'll have some sort of have a bit more inventory, especially on draft, to really supply the U.S. market, which will be great.
So Kyuchi, it's called Kyuchi Brewery, is that correct?
Yeah, the family is the Kyuchi family. The you know, Toshiyuki Kyuchi is currently running the show. Their beer brand is Hitachi No-Ness, and their sake brand is Kyukusakari.
So what did they make first? Did they make sake first or beer?
Great question. They've been making sake since the late 1800s, I think sometime in the 1870s. In Japan, there was a law that was sort of in place from the British occupation that said if you made sake, you can make as little or as much as you want. But if you made beer, you had to make a minimum of several hundred thousand barrels a year. Again, I'm not great with numbers. It was a very, very large number. Essentially, it was a protectorate thing put in place by Sapporo, etc. In the mid-1990s, that law was taken away. And essentially, you could have any size brewery you wanted to. So a lot of the smaller, more progressive sake producers in Japan started to make beer for the first time. And that was when Hitachi No-Ness got in the game.
Sorry, John, but Corey's actually shaking her head at some of the information you're giving. So I was curious what she had to say.
No, I'm sorry. You said British occupation? There has never been British occupation in Japan.
Right. I don't mean British occupation in the same sense that they occupied India, but a lot of the brewing culture that you have in Australia, that you have in New Zealand, that you have in Southeast Asia and Japan was sort of put in place by the British coming to sort of conquest the larger area of sort of Southeast Asia. Breweries the tradition of beer and the larger breweries in Japan and China and Thailand sort of have their roots in this.
Great. All right, John. And we have George here, George Cow from Mutual Trading. We're going to talk a little bit more about sake because that's why we're here today. How did you get involved in working in sake and telling us a little more about Mutual Trading?
Oh, great. Well, hi, Jimmy. Hi, Jen.
Hi.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me. Well, I started actually in the food world in New York City. Actually, my...
Wait, let's stop. If you don't know George, it's Cow or...
Cow.
Cow. Cow. If you don't know George, you don't know food in New York. I mean, every chef, you selling what, food products?
Yes.
And like,
yes.
What kind of super fancy specialty foods do you sell?
Well, I started with the ultra premium, you know, foie gras, truffles, Kobe beef industry. And I just slowly migrated towards my current position at New York Mutual Trading. We're an 85-year-old importer and distributor of Japanese, all things Japanese. So we have... Japanese foods, Japanese sakes, beers, and shochu. And for the past 10 years or so, business has been tremendously, you know, great. And we're starting to see humongous trends building in the Japanese sector. And I handle the East Coast for the alcohol distribution.
Well, there's one sake bottle that you have that everybody's oohing and eyeing over. What is it?
Yes, I actually brought three sakes today to try, or taste, if you will. And the first sake is Dasai 23. Now, this is a, I would say, medium-sized brewery from Japan, in located in Yamaguchi Prefecture. This is the southwest corner of the banana-shaped island called Honshu. And this sake is characterized as a Junmai Daiginjo sake. And for those who understand the characteristics and the way that we classify sakes, this is ultra-high premium. This sake tends to be very aromatic, very floral, and I would recommend, you know, serving this more towards an aperitif or during appetizers because of the aromatics that you get.
All right. Jen, are you not a fan of sake?
Well, I have been a fan. I, for whatever reason, don't have as much of a taste for it anymore. I'll divulge. But this tasting might actually get me back on board. Not that I was drinking bad sake or hot sake, God forbid. But and I read an amazing article a few years back that kind of demystified some of the categories. And those high, high ends, it has to do with the percentage of the rice grain, like the, what is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so I think a couple bits of information like that might be helpful for people out there who are trying to wrap their brains around these levels.
Basically, in order for sakes to be classified as premium sakes, they have a certain rules and regulations of brewing. And within those rules, we have 87 species of rice deemed fit. And within that, what we do is we mill off the outer core of the rice kernel, and we're trying to get to the center starch. Now, rice, as you know, is made up of lipids, proteins, and starch. But we just want the starch in order to create what we call saccharification. Now, rice in general is non-sugar. So in order to ferment, obviously we need sugar, so then we pitch the yeast in the water. After the saccharification happens, we're able to create beautiful sake because of the rice polishing.
Okay. So the polishing, like, it eliminates just impurities?
Correct.
It gives off cutting it,
flavors and profiles that you would not want. They're a little bit harsh and robust, so you definitely want the clean starch.
Okay.
Right. I'm sorry, this is John again. One really sort of interesting and, I guess you could say, convenient fact about the structure of a rice kernel is that all of the starches are in the center. And mm-hmm. sort of as you go from the center, you start to get the fatty acids and the other things that in the fermentation process contribute to all flavors. So, I mean, it's really only in
really
the 20th
smooth.
Century that we've had sort of the technology to really mill that kernel down so finely and to really get to the purity of the starch and create things like daiginjo sakes.
Exactly. The sakes that we have today are the best sakes the world has ever experienced. The technology that we're using to mill the rice has only been about 50 years. So the history in sake making, the daiginjo status or the classification, is only 50 years old.
Because they were incapable of maintaining the kernel and getting it down to that. Wow.
Yes.
George, what are some of the places in New York, some of the top places that sell your sakes?
Well, you know, basically, the no-brainer is any of the Japanese restaurants carry a wide variety of our portfolio. We have about 140 different brands. We're the largest importer of premium sakes in the nation.
Tell us the name of a couple bars and restaurants.
I would immediately say Sakagura is by far one of the most
famous. It's a great
place.
Yeah, everyone in this room is nodding at Sakagura. It's one of the most spectacular meals of my life was at Sakagura.
Yes, but, you know,
and environments in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
The ambiance. Yeah. Places like Matsuri, Morimoto, Soba Toto. I mean, a wide variety of Japanese restaurants, absolutely. But we try not to just stop there. We're trying to, you know, cross borders and really get into sake pairings with French, with Italian cuisine.
And I know at the Blind Tiger, we only have a beer and wine license. And mm-hmm. so it means that, you know, in order to diversify as far as we can, mm-hmm. sake is one of the things that we always have a couple because it's one, you know, it can fit under our umbrella.
Absolutely. It fits under
the wines. What about shochu? Shochu is different then.
Yes. There's somewhat of a difficulty understanding the difference between shochu and soju. Now, soju is the Korean word for a distilled spirit, basically similar to shochu. But within the word shochu, the distillery has to follow very strict regulations. Most of the shochus that you get here in the States will be single distilled shochus. So you're looking for those aromatics from either barley, potato, rice, sometimes sesame, sometimes brown sugar. And you really get those, you know, heavy notes. But if it is going through a continuous distillation, then perhaps you're not looking for such a fine, refined product. And therefore, you know, the products that probably are 35% to 40% alcohol by volume, used best for cocktails, is what you're looking
for. So shochu is a good mixer. You have it with a tea or some other mixer.
Yes, a very easy mixer. But lately, we're starting to see it as a straight.
Great. Corey, before we take a short break in a few minutes, but Corey, what do you think of this sake? Because I know you thought this was a special sake.
Oh, no. I mean, I've always been a fan of Dasai, and, you know, there are many amazing Daiginjos. I don't want to sound like I'm favoring one over the other, but I know that they have one of the best technical skills to make this Daiginjo. So I just love, I mean, thank you. Thank you.
Great.
I was just going to say...
Hold on. You're not on the show yet. Hold on. We're going to take a short break.
We'll get to him.
We'll be back and talk more about Japanese sake thought. And beer on Beer Sessions Radio.
If you don't want to, don't have to. If you don't want to, don't have to. If you don't want to, don't have to.
Get in trouble.
Say
you better leave my woman alone.
Well, I know you are a playboy, and you've got the women all over town. But listen, buddy, if you ever sweet talk my little girl, I'm gonna lay your body down. If you don't want to, don't have to.
Get in trouble.
You know you don't want to.
Oh,
yeah.
Get in trouble.
If you don't want to, don't have to.
Get in trouble.
Oh, you better leave my woman alone. Well, I know you got your money, and you've got a new 56 too. But if I ever see my little girl in your new car, I'm gonna do some work on you. If you don't want to, don't have to.
Get in trouble.
You know you don't
want.
All right. Okay, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm here with Jen Swartman from Blind Tiger, Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43. Quite a group of guests. So we've been talking about sake a little bit, Japanese beer a little bit. Well, now we've got a really cool guest who's actually located next door to us here at Roberta's. His name is Philip Gilmore from Momo Sushi Shack. How are you, Philip?
I'm good. How are you?
Tell us about your place. You're at Roberta's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm at Roberta's a lot because I only have a beer and wine license, so I don't have tequila. So that's why I'm.
Where
Roberta's.
Is your place?
I'm right next to Roberta's, right next to the liquor store, right on the corner here.
So you're in Bushwick?
Yeah, I'm in Bushwick. We're at 43 Bogart, and
Called Momo Sushi. Shack.
It's called Momo Sushi Shack. Our website is momosushishack.com, and I started it with my friend Makoto Suzuki, who's the owner of Bozu in Williamsburg. That's been there for about 8 years, and that's when I first started learning about sake is over at that restaurant.
So you're quite are you a sake expert or a sake enthusiast?
I've been drinking sake for about 4 to 5 years now, and when I first started drinking sake, I realized that I didn't love red wine and beer that much. I like them a lot, but sake, I just love it. I'm very passionate about it. Yeah.
So what are some of the sakis that you really enjoy that we could buy at your place?
The first one I brought today is called Suijin. This is a Junmai, so that means that they don't add any alcohol or water to it. And I will say that I am not perfect, so if there's anything that you either want to correct me about, anybody in the room, I am not above it. the first thing, when people try Suijin, what I like to tell them is that... when you hear the word dry with sake, it's not the same as when you are talking about like even a white wine or a red wine. Sake is always going to have floral notes. It's always going to be little bit sweet. But if you guys want to try this one, this is about as dry as sake gets, I think.
Jen, are you trying sakis?
Yes, I am trying. And that last one was so good that it does remind me. I'm not sure what happened.
I think that for people that are in New York restaurant world, I think a lot of people have a familiarity with good sakis. But I think that if you haven't been introduced to it, I mean, sake is like, it's black and white. It might be, cold sake or hot sake. I mean, what's the problem with sake? Why is it misrepresented so often?
I think because there hasn't been a big advertising push personally. Like, I don't probably think Four Loko is that good, but they have sold a lot of it. You know, I mean, I think it's about advertising. I don't think there's a big push. If you advertised sake properly and people tasted it, it would build from there. That's what I've always told people. But
it's my impression that back when they were first importing any sake, we got all the worst possible sake, and then they just started heating it up, which I don't. You don't do that in Japan, do you?
Actually, we do serve hot or warm sake.
Okay,
but unfortunately, this is the story I usually give people is. You know, in the beginning of the importing days, about 40, 50 years ago, when we started bringing sake to the States, the logistics weren't really set in place. What I mean by that is refrigerated containers were not really part of the game plan. So by the time the sake actually got to the United States shores, they were starting to go a little turn. You know, I always say sake is brewed like a beer, sips like a wine. Now, there's so many familiarities with sakes to beers. We're using actually the same top fermenting ale yeasts. Instead of a single fermentation, it goes through multiple parallel fermentation. And we can talk about that maybe, you know, later.
Next show.
Yeah. But
that's sake 201.
Yeah. Yes. But we didn't have things in place. So by the time the sakes were stored in warehousing, then went to distribution, by the time it got to restaurants, it probably skunked a little bit. And, you know, ultimately, business is business. You have to sell what you have. So, unfortunately, sake bombs or heating sakes to an extreme amount when we start seeing steam, that's just way too much, no matter how much people say heating sake is correct. In Japan, I would say, heated sake can get up to about 95 to 100 degrees Fahrenheit, so about body temperature, and that is actually opens up sakes tremendously.
And do you heat all levels of sake? Is it like
no? So like the first one that we just tried, the Dusai 23, I would not heat. I would keep that chilled, and I would serve it. I would treat it just like a Chardonnay or a Sauvignon Blanc.
Sure.
But I actually have a sake that's a very dry sake. This is a Oze no Yukidoke, O Karakuchi. So Karakuchi just means very dry, and I would actually serve that warm.
Okay, Corey, so in drier.
Japan, what are the different cultures related to sake? Like when people go out, do they go to sake bars, or they drink sake in restaurants?
At home?
Well, I mean, see, it's not really culture, and it's sad to say that not much people are consuming sake these days. I think shochu has really taken over because you don't really get hangovers that much with shochu. And even in my days, you know, I'm not that young, but even in my days, I was exposed to more beer and wine than sake. But because of my family history, that I've always had, and I've always had exposure to good sake.
Well, one reason that we became friends is that one time you told me the history of your grandfather. Your grandfather was influential in the sake business in
yes.
Japan.
Yes. I shouldn't say sake business, but, you know, listening to what everybody else was talking.
Craft,
yes. It's artistry of sake making. You know, it was really interesting hearing people talk because George mentioned about, you know, adding yeast, but that was not part of the method before. My grandfather, and it's not just, you know, my grandfather, but I just want to make sure that everybody understands that there were so many people who dedicated their lives to sake making.
Sounds familiar.
Familiar?
Yeah, to our craft brewing industry here. Mm-hmm, you know, a mm-hmm. lot of people who are in it for the passion.
Mm-hmm. It really does. It sounds like it was a beautiful time.
Yeah, and my grandfather's passion was to create chilled sake because chilled sake was not really consumable back in those days because of sanitary reasons. And the fact that you add yeast earlier in the process really made it prevent sake from rotting, and you did not have to heat it. And I brought...
Corey, before you... So what year was your grandfather working in these methods and things?
I mean, he has, you know, this was like early... 1910 was the year that he introduced his invention, which was supposed to be the revolution to the sake industry. His dream, and I brought the article here, but it's in Japanese. But in actually 1933, he was first able to, I shouldn't say first, I'm sure there were many other people who were experimenting, but I have a news article from Asahi Shimbun, the major newspaper in Osaka, that, oh, you know, Mr. Eda has, my last name is Eda, and my grandfather's last name was Eda too, but saying that he was first able to produce, not first, but it says first in the article, but I doubt it, but this sake, chilled sake, but, and from the article, it sounds like, you know, unpasteurized sake, which I'm sure George have, you know, a lot of information about.
So you're saying that, and this is probably, you guys will agree with me, that at one point you're saying they only served pasteurized sake.
No, they had to heat it to be sanitary. Yeah, they had to
so
heat it.
So that's interesting.
So that, does that mean they were pasteurizing it? What do you guys know? No. Is that what's going on,
so,
George?
There's two things. So when Corey was mentioning 1910, actually a lot of things in the sake industry were happening in 1909 to 1911. The advent of Kimoto styles coming back, expediting fermentation. But let me talk a little bit about the pasteurization. Over 200 years before Louis Pasteur lent his name to pasteurization, the Japanese were using a technique called hiire. And hiire is a very slow raising of the temperature, and what basically they did was they were pasteurizing. For 30 minutes, they would raise the temperature to about 65 degrees Celsius, and this would kill off the unwanted microbes that would give you the chance of spoilage. They didn't know specifically and scientifically why this happened, but through trial and error, this was a practice that was done throughout the land. Just to give you a little demographic, if you will. Today, we are unfortunately left with about only 1,000 active breweries left in Japan. Early 1900s, there was over 30,000.
You mean sake
that
breweries?
Also
sake
sounds breweries. Familiar
yes.
with the United yes. States and our craft brewing.
So, yeah, absolutely. It's a losing art form. But, you know, I also kind of blame it towards globalization. You know, the piece of the pie, sake was pretty much the dominating force. 1976 was the peak in
sake. Well, let's go back. Wait, let's stay around 1910 or earlier.
Okay.
I've never heard any of these stories, and this is brilliant. You guys are on the cutting edge of sake ever. So you're
cutting
saying
edge
that
by going back to 1910.
There was an not quite understood pasteurization going on
hundreds of years ago.
Right. And then, John, what do you want to say? What was going
on? Sorry, I was going to chip in. We were talking sort of about the massive drop-off in the number of sake breweries since then. Mm-hmm. Especially in recent times, it's actually less analogous to America because America had this wonderful thing called Prohibition that essentially killed the brewing industry. The sake brewing situation in Japan is much more analogous to Great Britain, where you have the very proud tradition of real ale and very proud tradition of sort of local breweries supplying very very fresh, recently conditioned beer to local bars. And it's really more analogous to the decline of that, where you have in Japan the situation with, Scotch whiskey and with shochu and things like that, sort of attacking and eating and beer production attacking.
So at the more sake. More like potentially industrial products taking over from artisanal products.
To a certain extent, it's a little it's part that and part just pure alcohol. Sort of combating artisanal production.
Well, can we go back to 19? I think this is.
But let's go back to
1910. Corey, let's go back to 1910. So your grandfather was working on a special process.
Yeah, but yes. But before that, I just want to mention that and this is something that I learned. Not I didn't learn this when I was growing up in like history. Yet I had no idea that many of the wars, like Russo-Japan War, Sino-Japan War, they were funded by the taxation to sake. So during that period, it was very important for the Japanese government to stabilize the production of sake. So what happened was during the Meiji Restoration, and that ties into the number 30,000 breweries, because up until then, you had to have license. But then the Japanese government said, you know what, anyone with capital, you can make it. So that's why it grew, but there were setbacks, as I'm sure George knows.
Absolutely. The data varies a little bit, but ballpark 90% of the Japanese war chest was funded by taxation of sake. So you can imagine how important it was for local breweries to actually have a business, a thriving business, so that the government could collect tax.
Wow, this is heavy stuff. Philip's dying to come in on this.
I was going to ask you, when did Honjozo show up?
Honjozo actually, Honjozo basically means a sake that has been brewed and fortified slightly with brewer's alcohol. This alcohol is today very similar to cachaça. It's made of sugarcane. It's a distilled spirit. And what the theory behind Honjozo is that the alcohol opens up flavors your palate would not normally detect, right? This is, you know, on the other side of Junmai. So when I talk about sakes and I do sake trainings, I split the sake world into two hemispheres, a Junmai world and a non-Junmai world. And within the non-Junmai world, if it's not a Daiginjo or a Ginjo, it's a Honjozo. Honjozo means 70% or more of the rice is remaining, 30% was removed, and you're able to create a very aromatic and floral sake, relatively speaking, but it is fortified with alcohol, and that actually opens up and I like to say blooms the sake a little bit.
Wasn't the original Honjozo almost like a not like bathtub gin per se, but wasn't it World War II that Honjozo popped up?
Yes,
and it was like which I always tell people it's also almost equivalent to Prohibition mm-hmm. because they were making small batches of sake because people need to have rice to eat, but they also need sake to drink. So they're making small batches and then adding just alcohol and water.
Correct. Yeah. And the Honjozo itself, you know, there's so many analogies with the beer world. This is actually a great segue. I like to always talk about the Honjozos of pre-World War I. And what I mean by that is they didn't have strict regulations back then. Today's Honjozo cannot be past 10% alcohol per solids. So if you're using 100 kilos of rice, you cannot add more than 10 kilos of the liquid, the distilled spirit. Back in the day, there were no rules. Yeah. So oftentimes, it was three times, it was cut 3-1, actually. Mm-hmm. Water to alcohol mm-hmm. and a little bit of rice to give you that flavor.
And if you ever have a machine sake, it is 100% Honjozo.
having a what sake?
A hot sake. I always tell people too that Honjozo is either the bottom of the barrel or like one of my favorites. Like if you have Honjozo, if you have Honjozo, it's either going to be really cheap or really expensive.
Philip, have you been to Japan?
No, I've been there in spirit.
I feel like you've been there.
Yeah. Nope.
If you did go to Japan. Which region would you go to, and what sake would you want to, you know, sake brewery would you want to visit?
I mean, I love Desai. I would definitely go to Desai. There's too many for me. It would be impossible.
Where is Desai? Where is it?
Yamaguchi Prefecture.
Yamaguchi, yeah.
There's four main islands in Japan. Honshu on the bottom left portion of Honshu.
I do love that when I look at, you know, in New York, there's a place like Astor Wines. Mm-hmm. I mean, they always have a really good selection of sakes. You know, I know there's the top Japanese restaurants, but, you know, around the country, do you think that there's enthusiasm for sake in good wine shops and other places?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So that could be a good place to learn about it.
The sake boom is really rising. A lot of people are taking notes and asking for more education. And this is really an education-based product.
John, what did you have to say?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I was actually going to ask a question, which is, sort of, I was going to offer up a question, which is, you know, what sort of other resources could people recommend to learn about sake? I think that John Gautner's books are spectacular. If people have the opportunity to attend John Gautner's seminars, I know he hasn't done many of them in English, many of them in the States, but
What's his name, John?
John Gautner. But maybe someone else could speak more.
Who is he?
Do we know the name of the
book?
Let
someone else hammer that down.
Well, Philip, do you know John Gautner?
I do. I don't know him personally, but I was going to tell when people have no idea about sake, they know nothing about sake, and they say, how can I learn? This sounds so ridiculous, but if you type in the word sake on Wikipedia and you memorize that page, followed every link, and memorized those pages, you are a sake expert.
So who's this John Gautner, George?
John Gautner is actually one of my sake teachers, if you will. He offers a very thorough...
Is he American?
Yes, he is. And he actually lives in Japan. So for the past 10, 15 years, I believe, he's lived in Japan and dedicated his life to the education of sake.
Yeah, if I can add very slightly, he's actually from Cleveland. Yes. He has a pretty distinct Cleveland accent. It's really great. And he's married to a woman from Japan and has lived in Japan for about a decade or so.
Wow. This is cool. Well, one more time, we're going to take a short break and check in at Heritage Radio Network here at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We'll be back in a few on Beer Sessions Radio.
I put a spell on you. Because you're mine.
stop the things you do. What's up? I ain't lying. Yeah, I can't stand. Woo! No running around. I can't stand. No putting me down. I put a spell on you.
Okay, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're having a great time here. We're drinking some really good sakes and beer at Roberta's in Bushwick in Brooklyn. Well, Philip, what was the statement?
Oh, I was going to just point out a quick thing I wanted to before I forgot, which was, you know, having worked at Bozu for 3 years, now owning Momo for over a year, I get to talk to people a lot about sake, and people are always surprised that sake is near in alcohol content as wine. Mm-hmm. And I think that people are surprised by that because so many people are used to drinking hot sake. And when you drink hot sake, you have all those alcohol vapors. And, you know, a normal sake is between 12 and 16, 17%. And so I'd like to just destroy the misconception that sake is really strong, because people are like, they take one drink of sake and say, oh, sake's so strong. But it's actually like having a half an ounce of wine.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I have some more questions.
Now, so, you know,
George, we're drinking a sake now. It's a Nagori, but this tastes like an old-fashioned sake.
Correct. I'm glad you picked up on that. This is a Kikusui, Perfect Snow. This is actually a new sake that we just brought into the States December 1st. So it's only been in in the streets for 5 days. But this sake is rather very cloying. It's one unique thing about this is it's 21% alcohol by volume. So this is a sake that's Nigori, but it's also Honjozo. So there's slight alcohol fortification in this. This is also, I believe, a Genshu. Genshu simply means cask strength.
Is this like a party sake?
This would be a good kickstart to a good party, I think. What can I say? It's very big, it's very rich, bold, but because it's 21%, this extends a huge repertoire for mixing. What unique thing that the Japanese have discovered is mixing this with milk. Now, this is very counterintuitive, but actually, when you mix this 50-50 with milk, it's utterly delicious.
Well, it has sort of a milky mm-hmm. consistency. The mouthfeel is completely different than the other two that we had.
Mm-hmm.
The unfiltered
yes.
sort of,
yes.
yeah.
Jen, you're not the biggest fan of sake, but are you becoming a fan of sake?
I'm revisiting sake. I actually liked sake for a while, and I don't know. I didn't have a bad experience like sometimes people have with a certain alcohol, and then they can't go back to it. But I just sort of one day like realized I didn't have much of a taste for it. But I think I need to just study it enough to refine my parameters, because sake is quite diverse. There, it's a huge range, and I know that there's a lot of terminology that I don't understand, so I probably just need to figure out what styles, just like when you start learning about beer and how you have to learn what styles you respond to until your palate gets to a certain point. And I might have overshot it, just like somebody who overdoes it with hops when they're brand new to craft beer.
Yeah, I mean, I I don't have any thoughts on what you might have done or might not have done. I will say that sort of...
I have no idea. Not that I don't remember the night, but I don't know exactly what I was drinking.
Because I don't know,
understand
before.
Enough.
Yeah, right. To speak to my experience, I think that there was a certain intimidation with sake where I assumed that it might be the difference between learning about bourbon and learning about Scotch whiskey, and that I can afford bourbon and I can't afford Scotch whiskey. I mean, I can't afford the $20 a shot for the next 2 years.
But then also, aside from the expense, those two flavor profiles within the whole whiskey umbrella are so dramatically different. And some people gravitate to certain flavors and some gravitate to others.
I think that's very true. And what I was sort of pleased to find is that in the sake world, there was actually a much wider array of flavors available to me at a reasonable price point than I expected. Yeah. And sake has a really distinct regionality even. You can really start to taste and start to sense sort of the different regional characteristics, even at a pretty reasonable price point. And as long as what you're having is Junmai, it's going to be
John
premium.
John and George, are there any special sake events going on in the next 6 months that someone could learn? You know, I want to go and taste through, like, you know, 20 flights of sake. And
I'll tell you my favorite sake
every
bar.
Every night at Momo.
Momo, is that what you do?
Every night it is a special sake tasting at Momo every single night. And sometimes in the morning and sometimes in the afternoon.
I have a favorite sake bar, though, in the East Village, Decibel.
Yes.
That place is great.
Do they really have good
sake?
There's
so much atmosphere. And
one of the great
Momo, tell us. We're going to just call you Mr. Momo because you're Mr. Momo. Tell us again.
Tell them about it.
Momo, where are you? Bogart, what?
43 Bogart on the corner of
Moore. In which neighborhood?
Bushwick.
Brooklyn, America?
Brooklyn, America.
And you have a website?
Yes, momosushishack.com.
I love you, man.
Thank you, man.
This guy is changing what you would think of sake.
You know what I tell people is sake is like country music or hip-hop. If you haven't heard a country, I hate country. Well, you haven't heard the right country music song. I hate hip hop.
And
you
we talk about that with beer all the time, on this show and everywhere.
If somebody doesn't like sake, they just haven't tried the right one.
Exactly. That
Mr. Momo,
to the ramen is soul food idea.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Wait, stop, Mr. Tell us a little more about the food that you serve at Mr. Momo. You're going to change the name to Mr. Momo.
Yeah, Mr. Momo Sushi Shack. well, we're taking basically how I would describe it in less than 2 hours would be we're taking traditional Japanese cooking techniques and then using seasonal, organic, and local ingredients as much as possible. So, like, let's say, for instance, if you get a tempura in my place, it's going to be done exactly how tempura should, but then we're going to be using something like zucchini flowers or candy striped beets or, purple carrots.
Cool. And then the sake that you buy, how many bottles of sake do you have at Momo?
I have a very small restaurant. It's only 800 square feet. So right now we have it rotates a little bit, but nine different types of sake, but they're all different styles. I have
In New York, which distributors do you buy from?
I did a big sake tasting at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens. It was a bonsai lecture and sake lecture. And the JFC company, sponsored the event, so I told them that I would use them for 1 year. So, George, I'm going to be talking to you in February.
Thank you.
I would like to say, too, I'm so honored that this sake that we're drinking, the Nigori, has only been here for 5 days, because 5 days ago, the owner of the company came and had lunch at Momo. So I'm so honored that I was one of the first to have it in the whole world.
Yay.
Well, as you know, the way I've always bought sake
in the Western world
is that I buy it by distributor. Like, I know that Mutual Trading is a good name. Yeah. There's Japan Prestige.
Yeah. World Sake. And Andrew over at World Sake is amazing.
For a long time, I took the easy way out, and it was great. The full lineup of Hitachino, the Kyuchi Sakis, was a few years ago at Jimmy's number 43. I think I had all the Sakis on our menu. And the funny thing was we sold them out, so I should have kept buying them, but for some reason I didn't.
Well, the other thing about the sake line from Kyuchi, the Kikusakari sake line, is that in Japan, Kyuchi is very known for making less, more esoteric versions of sake. For instance, they are very, very proud of their Taro sake. They're very proud of their Asamura sake, and their Daiginjos are also very, very, very extreme and very specific to their regionality.
Are they getting creative with it and doing things that are just completely non-traditional, or?
They actually have a very, very good sense of sort of taking aspects of the tradition and sort of manifesting them in new and original ways.
Well, once again, that sounds like an ongoing theme with what we do here.
Heck yeah.
You know, another
and
beer
George,
analogy.
Yes. Going back to, when Corey and I were talking about the Japan disaster this year, but it feels like last year. Thank God. It was such a we've moved on so much. Gosh, that was horrible. You know, I have to say this. Last year, the Japan, the earthquake and the tsunami. I mean, one reason we're doing this show tonight is everyone in this room, we have such a connection to Japan, Japan products, Japan culture. It's inspired many of us to think of a different life, in the field that we're in. I mean, in restaurants and food and beverages, Japan is really set a standard for so many things. And when that disaster happened, we really felt it. And to do the Brewers for Brewers event last spring, it was something that we would not have been able to not do. But George, tell us what's going on with the sake and other companies that you work with in Japan right now?
Yeah, well, with regards to the relief efforts, you know, I actually, every year I take a few trips to Japan and I visit some of my breweries, and actually I was stuck in Japan during the earthquake. I was scheduled to fly back March 12th, and March 11th, the big earthquake hit. I was fortunately in Kyushu, so I didn't, you know, receive any of the residual, you know, shock and stuff. But when I got back to Narita, the planes were all, you know,
backed just, up.
Yeah, completely ages. Backed up, and I was stuck there for 24 hours. They sent out, you know, emergency sleeping bags. You know, everything was taken care of, but aftershocks every 30 minutes, and these are like Richter scale fives. So that was, you know, really, really scary. And I feel considerably lucky that I'm here in the United States in a safe, you know, environment talking to everyone here. But in terms of the relief efforts, yeah, a few of our breweries were hit from the atrocities, but everyone has somewhat, you know, pulled together. And I think that's the very unique thing about this small industry and environment is, you know, we're all really just family, you know. We had a humongous charity event. A lot of the different distributors and importers got together a month after the earthquake. And in New York City, I think we raised close to $90,000. And that was immediately sent to the Japan Society Red Cross earthquake relief.
You know, Jimmy, as far as Brewers for Brewers, I know you and I have talked about this privately a little bit, but there's actually a batch of beer at Hitachino that was in the maturation, in the temperature-controlled maturation tanks when the earthquake and the tsunami hit, that essentially spent 3 or 4 days in the maturation tanks without power. And it developed some really interesting secondary fermentations, probably from lactobacillus and some other things. And it's really, really delicious. I had the opportunity to taste it.
What did they call it?
Well,
Brewers for Brewers.
I got to taste it maybe 3 or 4 months ago, and it's really spectacular. And we will be bringing in a bunch of it and making it available exclusively to accounts that raised money for the relief effort.
What is the name of it?
And we're calling it 3 days because that's how long we went without power.
Well, one more thing. We're definitely going to do another sake show. We have to. And everyone in this room, we will be back. We're all friends now. And just what we usually do after the show, we hang out here at Roberta's in Brooklyn. We have dinner. There's pizza. There's foie gras. There's steak. It's kind of a treat, but hey, we earned it. But going back to the sake, is there a tradition of sake home brewing? Do people do that in Japan?
That's a great question.
There is a style called doburoku that is a very easy fermentation. But in terms of creating a sake of this caliber, making sake is so, so difficult. So home brewing is almost an impossibility.
But it's illegal, too, these days.
But if you're in America, the next time we come back on, we're going to talk about, you know, who knows, maybe in a few months we'll schedule the show, but we could definitely talk about how to do home brewing of sake. Is that possible, John?
Well, he's just saying it's not, Jimmy. So well, you might be able to.
I mean, there's two major challenges. One is that you need to mill away at least 50%, if not, you know, 60, 70% of the rice grain.
And we don't have access to those mills.
And then the other thing is that, as opposed to barley, you know, where you can malt barley very easily by essentially starting the germination process, rice don't malt. So you have to use koji, which is a bacteria. So, yeah, making sake at home is very challenging. It's not impossible. It's very,
but,
very
you're in a little bit over your head.
Well, I'm not, because I'll tell you why. Because until 1979, homebrewing was illegal. But now for a homebrewer, you can buy malt, you can buy
they're
hops.
They're telling you scientifically what it takes.
Scientifically.
It's like, yeah, it's not as easy. Oh, we're just going to get a bag of rice and
I think we're going to make some sake.
Mr. Momo here is going to be behind it.
Yeah.
I get a feeling, Mr. Momo, we're doing this. We're going to have a challenge. We're going to have a home sake making
challenge. I do not want that sake.
I promise everybody in this room, I could have sake ready in exactly 1 year if I had $2 million.
You got it. See? It's not impossible.
We're opening it up to the public now. Yeah, it's not impossible.
It's not impossible.
You just need $2 million.
Well,
and a sake maker from Japan.
We can try to make a very sweet sake, and that's possible.
There is a sake coming out of Berkeley that I've had before. Berkeley, California. Yes. There's
with
a
American
sake.
Rice.
Yeah.
Shochikubai from Berkeley,
that's
California.
That's the one I know of that's domestically fantastic. Produced. But, and it's, you know, it's an unfiltered, you know.
But the facility is state of the art.
But Corey said,
that helped. $2 million.
In Japan, is home sake making illegal? So perhaps no one's really tried. Is that true?
I'm sure that some people have tried it, but it's not publicized.
And maybe it's
I'd
not
like
very
to point
good.
Out that marijuana is also illegal in Japan. But
we got somewhere with the show, Jenna. I think that
I learned a lot.
We got a chance to talk about some new things.
And now Jimmy's going to start his like small batch sake, sake. Home brewing system in the basement of Jimmy's.
Why not? Well, anything going on at Blind Tiger this next weekend?
We've got, well, it's not the weekend. It's Wednesday. Tomorrow, we're going to have a holiday beer event. 14 holiday beers of all kinds from all over the world. So that'll be fun.
And Mr. Momo, anything special happening at your place in the next week or two?
Every night, special.
Tell me, what sake should I drink at your place tonight?
The one we actually didn't get to, which was the Chiyo Masubi, which is one all of my right. favorite, the Tokubetsu.
John, anything going on with any of your special bars in New York City?
Well, you know, there's this bar in the East Village called Jimmy's 43, and actually there's a $10 tasting of 6 rare beers from B-United tonight. So if anyone is listening to this live, I couldn't recommend Gang Out enough.
All right. And George, anything happening in the world of sake in the next couple of weeks?
Well, you know, I'm doing a lot of traveling. This year I logged about 100 days on the road. So all over the East Coast, you know, there's events here and there. But, you know, we'll definitely keep you guys updated with, you know, upcoming
and
events.
How do I learn more about your travels?
My travels?
You have a website or something?
Come on. Well, I'm also the culinary director of the Japanese Culinary Center in Manhattan, and we do a lot of culinary events. So actually on the 15th, we're doing a motsunabe, which is a southern Japanese, you know, hearty, stick-to-your-ribs type of stew, hot pot. And, you know, that's up and coming.
Corey, do you give a thumbs up to that? Thumbs up?
Yeah, and but, you know, with that, I would love to have shochu.
Yes.
So too. All right. And Jimmy's number 43 and December 17th. It's our second annual Battle of the Belgians. Best of the American Belgian style.
Yeah, I should have promoted that too. We got a bunch of my beers on that.
Yeah, well, that's
fun.
What everyone's coming for. Everyone's coming for the B-United. Just, John, tell us about a few of the top Belgian beers that you guys sell.
You know, for Battle of the Belgians, I'd say the three highlights we got are the Brasserie à Vapeur Saison de Pipe, the historic Saison recipe from the 1700s, brewed by the world's last 100% steam-powered brewery. We got De Dol Orbia Reserva, which is matured 18 months in Bordeaux wine barrel. And I promised three. Also, a relatively new beer to the New York market, Smitskje from Brewery Smitskje. Sort of a very, very intense, very hoppy.
Is that the one that's
pale
like T. Schmitschke?
Yeah, that's the one. Smitskje means blacksmith, but they replaced the J with a K for this beer. And I don't.
And
know
they also
means.
Make like a mustard beer, don't they?
Yeah, Vestincha. It's a yeah. really beautiful. They're a spectacular
well, you
guys, brewery.
Listen, and what's the website for B United?
The letter B, BUnitedInt.com.
I will say it's a tough site to navigate, but you guys are working on it. But there's so many beers from so many countries.
Yeah, that's the issue.
Japan.
It's too much information. We got yeah. you got hundreds and hundreds of beers.
And you guys
from
do a great job.
Countries.
And your founder's name is what?
Matthias. Matthias is my boss. He runs the company. We've been around
and
for about 15 years now.
You guys are just a special part of New York beer. And one more thing: Monday, December 12th, at Beer Table, whiskey, distilled beer, and beer tasting event. Also coming up, the Get Real New York presents Beer Bar Fest, December 10th. I think you go to getrealnewyork.com for more. I'd like to thank our sponsors at greatbrewers.com. Thank you again. You guys have an awesome site, and it keeps getting better. Beer Sessions Radio is supported by the Good Beer Seal, goodbeerseal.com. Thanks to Jen, Phil, Corey, John, and George for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee and Bree O'Connor, and guest coordinator, Brett Thompson. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio.
This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.